Okay, so welcome for our computer graphics lecture. So today I want to finish a nice algorithm for traversing KD trees. It's a way to intersect rays with a set of triangles. It's based on a data structure of a KD tree that we can see here. So the idea is that we have a bounding box for the entire scene that is hierarchically subdivided, and it's always subdivided into two halves. It's subdivided by a split plane that is parallel to the three coordinate axes. Okay, it's perpendicular to the three coordinate axes. So we can split the bounding box along x, y, or z, and we always split it at an arbitrary position of that plane, so that plane can be moved forward and backward. It's not always directly in the middle. Yeah, so that's the basis. And now we assume that we have a ray, and we know it intersects the bounding box of the entire scene. I mean, otherwise the ray cannot hit anything, so then it's trivial. Now we assume we have such a ray. We know it intersects our bounding box, and we also compute the ray parameter of where the ray enters the current bounding box and where it leaves it. Yeah, so that's T min, T max. Okay, so that's the kind of state that we have. Yeah, so we know we have this box, we have this entrance parameter and this exit parameter. And good. So that's essentially the same situation that I've drawn here on the blackboard. So our box, yeah, this is the ray, this is the entrance point, and this is the exit point. Okay, now we have two possibilities. Yeah. So one case is that this box here is the leaf of our hierarchy. Yeah, that means there are no further sub-boxes, and that means that this box here contains a set of triangles that are intersecting this box. So in that case, we just intersect that ray with the remaining triangles. Yeah, the test for this we were speaking about last week, how to intersect, or on Tuesday, how to intersect a triangle with a single ray. This we know how to do. That's simple. Now the other thing, the other case that we have to consider is that the box has been subdivided. Yeah, it has two child boxes. For now, we assume that it's split along the x-axis, so it's subdivided to left and right. But it could also be top and bottom, or and front and back. Yeah, if it's y or z. Okay, good. So how do we proceed now? The simple way, of course, would be the following, that we do a recursive algorithm and we say, okay, first we test whether we intersect the left bounding box. If so, we traverse the left bounding box, then we intersect, then we see whether we intersect the right bounding box and we traverse the right bounding box. Yeah, that would be the simple approach. But it's recursive, which has some disadvantages. And in fact, we can do that a bit more efficient. This is what I want to explain now in the following. So the core, here we have images for. Sorry, that's the wrong one. Okay, yeah. Now, the three interesting cases now that can happen with respect to the children can be seen here. Because, as I already said, it can happen. So this case that we both have to traverse the left and the right one, the right child, is not the general case. Yeah, There's also the possibility that our array only intersects the left child or it only intersects the right child. Yeah? So we have to differentiate these three cases. And this is quite simple by computing this intersection of the array with a split plane. And this is particularly simple because the split plane is, it is something like x equals x split. Yeah, it's a very, very simple plane. It's not rotated. Yeah, it's just a fixed x, y, or z coordinate. And if we have some ray that looks like this, e plus td, now should intersect this plane, we can very quickly compute that because it's just ex plus tdx equals x split. And we just have to solve for t. Yeah? So that's a very, very simple and fast computation. Can be done very quickly. OK, so now we compute the ray parameter for the intersection with a split plane. And now with this t split, we can very quickly differentiate these three. Because if our split parameter comes after t max, then obviously we only have to traverse the left one or the closer one. Yeah, because if the ray goes from right to left, then this one is the closer one. This is also a little distinction that we have to make. If t split comes before the entrance point, then we only have to intersect the further one. And only in that case, if t split is between t min and t max, we have to traverse both. And here we ideally first traverse the closer one and then the further one. Yeah? So that one that comes for smaller ray parameters and that one for larger ray parameters. OK, so in many cases, we will have these. So our recursion does not recurse to two cases, but only to one. Yeah? So when traversing our tree, we will typically only go to the left or to the right. And only in a few cases, we go to both. And in order to avoid recursion, what we do is that we use now a stack. And we use that stack to just remember nodes that we still have to examine. Yeah? And now if we have that case, for instance, we know, we only have to traverse the left child. So all that we do in that case is that we remember, or we push on the stack, this node. And additionally, for all these considerations, we do not only need to know the node, but we also need the ray parameter for the entrance and for the exit point. Yeah? And in that case, that's very simple because the t min and the t max are exactly the same as for the parent bounding box. Yeah? So in that case, we just push the left child together with t min and t max. Nothing we have to compute, essentially. In that case, it's exactly the same. We push the right node, and now t min and t max are exactly the same as for the parent node. And here, we push the left child and the right child. And as t min and t max, we use t min and the t split. That's this split parameter that we computed here. And for right, the new t min is t split, and t max is the old t max. Yeah? So we have this interval quickly computed. And now, because it's a stack, the thing that we push last is removed first, and we want this node to be examined first. So we first push the right or the further child and then the nearer child. And that's the one that in the next iteration then is immediately pulled off again. OK, so that's the core idea. I hope I didn't do a mistake at that place. I always differentiated between left and right and closer and further child. And here we see the difference, the distance again. So if our array goes from left to right, that means if the x component of the direction is positive, in that case, the closer one is the left node and the other one is the right node. And if the array goes from right to left, this is the closer node and this the further one. Yeah? So it's just, we can just differentiate by looking at this parameter. And at that case, we also see that if ray direction equals zero, if this ray is parallel, then we have to take care, or we have to consider this as a special case. That also is interesting because when computing the split parameter, yeah, we see T split equals X split minus EX over DX. Yeah, so here we have a division by zero if DX equals zero. So for that, we need a special traversal or a special case. Yeah, and here we see it can it always will either intersect the left or the right node. Yeah, it cannot intersect both. So in that case, it makes perfect sense to write, or for ray direction x, y, or z equals zero, we will write own traversal methods that take care of that. Okay, good. And in fact, in practical implementations, it's what you typically want to avoid is that you, for every new node, you query whether the direction or the x component of the direction is positive or negative or so. But instead, what you can do is that you eight different traversal methods are implemented, yeah, and each of these methods is for one certain scenario, that means x, y, and z larger or smaller than zero. Yeah, that gives you eight different possibilities, and for each a little own little traversal method can be used, because that ray direction doesn't change for a ray. Yeah, so for a particular ray, you can look at the signs and then call the right method. Yeah, that does the traversal for this particular setup of a ray direction. And now these are, again, special cases. So now if we say we have three different possibilities, then we end up with 27 different methods to traverse that hierarchy. That's a pain to implement, but it's not difficult, but it takes quite some time. Okay, yeah, and then it's really what remains in the end is very simple. Yeah, so that's the special cases. And where's the code? Ah, yeah, okay, yeah, this handle internal node is not here. But the remaining code is really quite simple. And if you imagine what happens during traversal, the only computation that needs to be done is this here. Yeah, that's all. That's where all the computation about intersection happens. Yeah, there's nothing more. It's only doing these computations and some comparisons, t min smaller than t split and so on. But there is no explicit intersection code between array and a bounding box, for instance, except for the root bounding box to initialize t min and t max. Otherwise, there's nothing complicated in there anymore. And so such a KD tree traverser can be implemented very, very efficiently. Yeah? And as a result, just to give you an impression maybe about numbers, on a current CPU, so nothing special with a single thread, with such a KD tree traverser, it is possible to trace something like 200 million rays per second. Yeah, that's already quite a bit. But if you compare it when using rasterization on a GPU, yeah, for the iRays, yeah, for the pixels that are projected onto the screen, they can generate billions of pixels per second. Yeah, so that's still much faster. But yeah, with a ray tracer, you can generate something like, yeah, just to say, 200 million rays. The number of rays strongly depends on, yeah, let's say two things. The first of all, how good is the hierarchy, this KD tree hierarchy that you saw before? Yeah, how well are the split planes chosen and so on? Of course, it also depends on scene size, but even for large scenes, the growth in complexity is not like with rasterization O of n, but in the ideal case, ray tracing is an O of log n method. Yeah, so because you have a tree, and the depth of the tree is the logarithm of n. So in the best case, yeah, you can, by doubling your scene, just means that your tree is one level deeper. Yeah, and you need one additional traversal step. So people for a long time argumented that scenes become more and more complex, and at some point ray tracing will be faster than than rasterization. And people claimed that already 10 years ago, and you know 10 years is a very long time in computer science, but it still hasn't happened. Yeah? Rasterization also became much faster, and even if asymptotically ray tracing must catch up at some point, it hasn't happened yet, and it doesn't look like it will happen in the near future. Okay, so I said there are two things it depends on. First, the quality of the hierarchy, and then the second thing is maybe more interesting, and that's the following. These high numbers of ray traversals can only be achieved for rays that are, for instance, all shot from the camera through the image plane, so for I rays. As soon as you continue, for instance, and generate secondary rays, reflection rays, rays to light sources, let's say you have many, many light sources and so on, then the performance will significantly drop down, yeah, by maybe a factor of 10 even. And the reason is that these I rays are very coherent. That means if I cast a ray here, and one here, and one here, yeah, the most of the boxes that have been hit by that ray will also be hit by the next ray. So all the information is already available and is in a cache and can be quickly accessed. But as soon as your rays bounce around randomly, almost randomly, this completely breaks down. Yeah, and it's a typical artifact, or not artifact is the wrong word, typical observation for good CPUs, that most or much of the performance depends on hiding the time for accessing memory by using caches. Yeah? And for that, these caches work perfectly well, and for that case, they don't work anymore. Yeah? And then performance completely is wrong, but significantly drops. So whenever you read numbers about how many rays per second does this method make, you have to closely look at whether it's coherent rays. That's that one. And that's essentially quite simple. Yeah, for coherent rays, achieving high numbers is simple. But this is then for incoherent rays. And this is much more a problem. Yeah? And in particular, it's a problem because we said ray tracing is very good because we can add nicely all these global illumination effects, but for these nice global illumination effects, such incoherent rays are necessary, and they are quite slow, or relatively slow. Okay, just to give you a little bit of insight, yeah, what people have to think about for that. Okay, now that's the stack and the special case, and that would essentially conclude that chapter. And if you have any questions on that, I would be, wow. So I have a new computer, and it has a display resolution of 3,200 pixels in width. And that's wonderful, but the problem is whenever I switch between my normal monitor, which has much less on a much larger size, I get letters of this size here. And Windows is not able to support different...
Yes, it is.
It is?
Since 8.1
it is. Oh, okay. This, if somebody gives me a possibility, this gives extra points for the assignments. Okay, not kidding. So please, if you tell me afterwards, I would be very happy. I Googled it and I found nothing. Okay. Good. So, were there any questions? Sorry, I didn't even look up to check. No. Okay, so what I want to continue now is to speak about the extensions of ray tracing. So up to now, we really only spoke about the simple things. Yeah. So I explained you how to shoot eye rays. We spoke about the simplest way of secondary rays to generate shadows, reflections, and refractions. And we spoke about accelerating this ray traversal. And I always said, OK, ray tracing is so nice because we, for instance, can add indirect lighting effects. And yeah, this is to this topic now. I want to dive a little bit deeper and give you some extensions of ray tracing and things that you can use to generate nicer images, yeah, than just the plain ray tracer that we had up to now. And I want to speak about two topics, distribution ray tracing and a bit more complicated ray differentials. But they are closely related, as you will see. Okay, so distribution ray tracing or distributed ray tracing, both terms are possible. And I think I already draw an image similar to that, to the blackboard, because it's rather, a rather obvious extension, I would say. So let's assume we have here the typical setup. We have a viewer looking into an image, and we have one eye ray. And now we look at a plane, and this plane is not a perfect mirror, but it's also not diffuse, it is glossy. Yeah? It's something like metal or so. Yeah? It's not a perfect mirror, but at least for close objects, you see something like a reflection, but this reflection is blurred. Yeah? That's the specular part of the Phong model. And now, in order to render such a scenario, you might say, OK, computing a reflection with ray tracing is simple. We compute the reflection ray. Yeah, that would be that one. And we follow that recursively. We saw that. And that gives me a reflection. But now we don't have a perfect reflection. We have a blurred reflection. So we could easily model that by not only casting one reflection ray, but several. And the several rays, they are all a little bit jittered around the main reflection direction. Yeah? So we have not one reflection ray, but let's say 20. Yeah? And they are all a little bit jittered. And as a result, for this point, we do not take the one reflection color, but we take all these 20 reflection colors and average them. And essentially, what that results in is that we take a perfect reflection image and blur that. Okay, that's the idea of distribution ray tracing. Yeah, that's very simple. And now the idea here we can see such a result. Yeah, so that's our well-known teapot with a perfect reflection. It looks like this, and if we jitter these reflections, we get such an image here. So you see that highlight becomes much bigger, and it's more blurry. The teapot, here it looks more polished, and here it has some roughness in it. Yeah, very simple. Okay, now maybe you might think, okay, that's exactly what we know from the Phong model, and essentially that's true, but it's not very simple to get the relation between this method and a Phong BRDF, because with a Phong model, we had an expression that says how important is a ray that is a little bit off the main reflection direction. Yeah, we have that cosine term to the nth that tells us that the further we go, the less important it is. But now here we don't really have a material description, but instead we just say we jitter the secondary rays a little bit around the main direction. Yeah? And if we want to have something more glossy, more diffuse, yeah, then we have to jitter more. And if we want to have it more glossy, then we have to jitter less. Yeah? So the material parameters are described by how far we jitter, yeah? And not by a real formula. And what we also achieve is if we jitter with an equal distribution, what we get is that all these directions have the same influence to the reflection. Yeah, so that's Phong has something like this. Yeah, so the further we go away, the less important it is. But here we have a cone, and everything within that cone has equal importance. So we could say, okay, we can change this by jittering and having more rays close to the reflection direction and less rays further away. Yeah, so the regions further away have less impact because they have less rays in the average, and so on. Yeah, so this relation between the or let's put it the other way around. Let's assume you have a surface described by the Phong lighting model. And now deriving which rays or how should these rays be distributed so that we get a result that is equivalent to Phong, this is not trivial. Yeah, depends on how far we get in the lecture, but maybe we will come back to that topic. I just wanted to explain that for now. Yeah, if you do that simple way of distribution ray tracing, the material property is defined by the algorithm, how far do we jitter these rays? Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, Phong is also not a physically based model, and it also has parameters that have no real meaning. So we could also use something like that, and in fact, we can generate. It's simple to generate nice results, so it works nicely, but. In fact, now this approach here is just the kind of most obvious approach of distribution ray tracing, and we can see that with this general idea, we can also handle other effects. And the main problem that we have with ray tracing, and that is sort of attacked by distribution ray tracing, is the following: that with ray tracing, we always only follow a single ray. Yeah, if we do reflections, we always only follow a single ray. But in fact, if we think about that a little bit, for instance, we know that the color of a single pixel is not only determined by the color at the center of this pixel. Yeah, and with this reconstruction thing and so on, you learned that maybe it even depends on color values outside this pixel, yeah, if we do that reconstruction using a sink filter. But at least it depends on the color of all rays in that pixel, not only of the single one here. So instead of only casting a single ray, we should essentially look at that little pyramid that is defined, yeah, by, okay, now this is the camera, sorry. This is the image plane. Yeah, we should at least look at this frustum defined by the camera position and that pixel, and that pixel has some size, yeah? Even if the size becomes smaller and smaller on today's screen, it still has some size. And in particular, if rays are followed over a longer distance, yeah, now let's assume here we have some reflection, yeah, then this size becomes larger and larger. And we only, always with our rays, we only sample the center of this. Yeah, but something interesting might happen here, or here, or here. And the idea now of distribution ray tracing, or this idea here, is essentially the same. Even if we only look at that first, only at that ray, the color of that ray now does not depend on a single reflection ray, but it depends on an entire region around that reflection ray. And with ray tracing, we always only sample single points, but essentially, yeah, we are interested in larger regions. And distribution ray tracing is just the idea, so whenever this happens, do not take a single ray for computations, but sample that domain that is interesting. So for the illumination here, this entire domain, directional domain, is interesting, so we do not cast one ray, but we cast several rays. And this idea now we can transfer, for instance, to anti-aliasing, depth of field, also motion blur, but I won't detail on that here in the lecture, glossy reflections, that what we just saw, and for area lights. So let's start with anti-aliasing. The idea of anti-aliasing now is exactly that what I've shown here. Yeah? So the color of that pixel should not only depend on the one color at the center, but we should sample this entire region here. Yeah? And essentially that means, instead of computing the color by shooting a ray through the single pixel, we take multiple positions here, yeah, and sample the color at multiple positions. And we can even take into account positions outside that pixel if we want to do a good reconstruction with a sync filter, for instance. Yeah? So do not shoot one ray, but already for that one, shoot several rays. Yeah, that would be distribution ray tracing for anti-aliasing. And of course, now to determine these positions here, you can imagine of several methods. Probably the first one that everybody will try first is to take a uniform grid. Yeah, we could say, okay, we can afford something like 10 rays per pixel. So 10 is not a square number, so we take 9. And now we take uniform grid of 3 by 3 positions, and now we cast rays through all these. And for all these, we do a computation, and then in the end, we average these to get the color of that pixel. Yeah, so that immediately means we have to do 9 times as much work, but the results will be worth it. We will definitely have much less aliasing. But what we will also see is that this pattern here is not a very good one. And the reason is that in standard scenes or typical renderings, we will often have horizontal edges. Yeah, that's very normal. Typically, you don't photograph like this, but you photograph like this. Yeah? So most lines or most edges in the images are horizontal or vertical. And in that case, if you have such a sampling pattern, these samples are perfectly aligned with your grid. So that means if your camera moves a little bit, yeah, in the next frame, this pixel will be down here. And suddenly, we will have 3 more samples, yeah, on the other side of the edge. Yeah? And the color here will change quite quickly. So it would make much more sense to rotate that grid a little bit. Yeah? So if we just take that pattern, yeah, and we move a line, then one after the other will come in, and we have a much smoother transition. And that really becomes visible. And this is the here rotated grid. Yeah, so it's here for a 2x2, but of course it also works for more samples. Yeah? Of course, now we have the same problem if we have edges that are aligned to that grid, but that's much less likely. Okay, another way, another method, is to use complete random points. Yeah, this also works well. It has the good advantage, the big advantage, that you can also generate something like a pattern with 12 samples. Yeah, you don't need a square number. You can take an arbitrary number, but of course this randomness always generates problems. Like here, for instance, you see the entire lower left quarter here is not sampled. Yeah? Just because it's random, but On the other hand, there are other regions that are oversampled and some regions are undersampled, so it's less even. That's also what we wanted. Yeah, we wanted to have it less even, but not that uneven. Yeah, so ideally something in between. And these two methods now are ways to generate sampling patterns that are sort of in between, perfectly even, and completely random. And that one, let's start with that one, that's simpler. Here the idea is that we take such a uniform grid, here a 2x2 one, and then we take each of these samples and move them randomly. Yeah? So that means they all have a uniform starting position, but from that position we all move them away a little bit by a random amount. Yeah? So the overall distribution is still quite uniform, but we also have some randomness in it. And that case also will not happen. Yeah? So the points will show up or will change color one after the other. So that's chittering. That's method one. And the other one, that's the one that generates the real best results. And that's what we call Poisson disk sampling. And here the idea, so it has nothing to do with fish, it's a name. And the idea here is the following. So let's assume we have this pixel and we want to distribute 8 samples with this algorithm. So we just select the first one randomly, yeah? And then we define a kind of security zone around that. So we draw a little disk around that, yeah? And we say, okay, within this disk, we need no further sample. Or it's not only that we don't need one, we don't want one. So we draw the next sample. Let's say that's here. So again, we draw that disk. Then we draw this one. And now we draw this one, yeah? And this one now is in that safety zone. Yeah, and so we say, okay, these two are too close, so we discard that one and draw a new one. That's here. Yeah, it's again too close. So we discard it and draw a new one. It's here. Yeah, okay. I can do that until the lecture is over, but next we end up here. So that one is free. We say, okay, yeah, that works. Again, we draw our safety zone and so forth until we have the 8 positions, yeah? And now, of course, we know that they all have a minimum distance, which is defined by that radius in the beginning. But of course, you also have the problem that you cannot do that as often as you might want to, yeah? But at some point, there's no free spot here anymore. So this radius must be defined such that you still have or put it the other way around. You need to know from the very beginning how many samples you want to position, and then you can select your radius such that you know you will always, or it will always terminate. Yeah? The last ones can require some time, yeah, because there might only be very few little spots left, and it takes some time until you randomly pick one of these. Okay, yeah? So this is the definitely slowest variant. This takes some time, and people think a lot about that. And I mean, in 2D, it's not a problem, but you can also use that for higher dimensional spaces and for dimension 5 or 6 dimensions. Yeah, this becomes really very, very computationally intensive. But for 2D, for our purposes here, for sampling pixels on a grid, it's just fine. Yeah, and it generates the nicest and most even distributions, which are still random. Yeah, they are not as regular as these, so they really have very nice distributions. So these are the distributions you would like to have. Okay, good. So that's a simple way to achieve anti-aliasing by just casting several rays through a pixel. There are extensions where people, for instance, always cast rays through the corners of a pixel, and only if the colors at the corners are very different, they cast additional rays in the center, for instance, or stuff like that. Yeah, you can try to even further optimize that, but that's the basic principle, and it's just a variant of distribution ray tracing also. And the next effect, but I won't, I will do that then next week. The next effect that can be handled with that is what we call depth of field. In German, that would be Schärfentiefe. And the effect can be seen here pretty well, or maybe not here, but here, is that typical with your camera, you have something like a focus plane. Yeah, that means your lens, or you have an additional slider for your lens where you can set the focus, and only objects in focus will be sharp, and the further you get away from the focus, objects get blurry. That depends on the aperture. If the aperture is small, then you have a large range where it's sharp or where this effect is barely noticeable. But with a large aperture, it becomes very noticeable, yeah? And this range where you have a depth, sharp image becomes very small. So this is something that is the eye is very much used to from photography, but with a simple pinhole model for cameras that we had up to now, we are not able to generate that, yeah? Because a pinhole camera, and this is what I will explain next time, always generates sharp images. It doesn't know something like what a lens looks like and aperture and stuff like that. But we will see that it's quite simple to compute that and to generate models, simple models for lenses, yeah, that allow us to generate this. But this again means that we have to cast multiple eye rays. Yeah? We have to sample this unsharpness. And this we can do with a method which is very similar to that one, yeah, where we cast through different positions on the image plane. But what we now chitter is not the intersection on the image plane, but the camera position, sort of, yeah, or the origin of our rays. And this I will speak about next Tuesday, 12:30, as always. See you then.